Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
We'd had a very good season at Tyrrell, and I was leading the World Championship going into Monza, which was the last Grand Prix in Europe. I knew I could secure the title before flying away, but then one of the rear tyres began to deflate during the race. I always had my mirrors focused on the rear tyres, because in those days we had a lot more punctures, so I saw it looking concave, and I came in. Those are the words of Jackie Stewart describing the early stages of the 1973 Italian Grand Prix at Monza, which he picked as his race of my life for Autosport in 2012. This pick, which decided the World Championship in Stewart's final season as an F1 racer, is the latest in our Race of My Life miniseries. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me today is Autosport's chief editor, Kevin Turner. Now, Kev, I think this one you're pretty excited about because, fair to say, you're a bit of a fan of Jackie Stewart, aren't you?
Yes, yeah, I think he was one of the absolute great F1 drivers, probably a little bit underrated, actually, because he's sort of been a character that's been around for, you know, so long, and people say, oh yeah, that's Jackie Stewart, but actually it's easy to forget how meagre he was when he was in Formula 1. And also he very generously gave me his time, about an hour and a half a couple of years ago, to actually go through the top 10 races of his career, which is a rare opportunity to be able to do that with some of the great drivers on the list that I've been working on. So yeah, that was a very, very good experience, and he took it as seriously and as fun as you'd hope. You know, he gave you quotes on the races that were obviously going to be in the 10, disagreed with a couple of things, moved things around, and then made a couple of suggestions, which is sort of perfect, really.
Yeah, that sounds proper, and I can imagine he was fairly robust or sort of dismissive of some of your picks, or we'll come on to that later on, because there are a couple of alternatives obviously that we've got that we could put forward as what would be number one. But I think he certainly made his feelings known on a few of them.
He did, although he was very diplomatic. He's a professional. I mean, one thing I remember about interviewing him on something else actually was that he stopped himself halfway through to check a fact that he was about to tell me, and he went, hang on a minute, and he got up from his sofa, walked over to his bookcase, pulled out the auto course of the right year, checked the session times, said, yep, that was it, put it back, and then carried on with the interview, because he wanted to make absolutely sure he was accurate. So yeah, that's very helpful from a journalistic approach,
yeah,
as well.
It makes all the facts proper.
Perfect. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
I went over to his house in Geneva a couple of years ago. We did a feature in Autosport magazine about his thoughts on Britain's first world champions and how he rated them and racing against them and stuff like that. But at the time, it was before the halo was going to be introduced for the 2018 F1 season. Obviously, it was a massive, massive big deal at the time. There were so many arguments about style and looks and things that, you know, I think we've come a little bit accustomed to. I think if you dig into it, it's still there under the surface, but let's not go there, because that's a ridiculous debate. But anyway, what he said was that he was, because obviously he's a very famous safety crusader in F1, and I asked him about it. We wanted to do a story for the website, get it in the magazine as well, and he was like, yeah, it's, we need it. And he was really, really forthright in his views, and he came, you know, just like, yeah, it's, you know, whatever, if it's a safety development, we need it, let's do it. And I was like, it's great, fine, whatever. We did the rest of the interview, the feature, we came away. A few days later, I got an email from Jackie Stewart's PA saying, so Jackie would like to speak to you about something he said in the interview. And I thought, oh, here we go. What's he going to say? Can we perhaps change it or massage it, or, whatever. Because occasionally we do get that with racing drivers, and you have to be diplomatic and say, no, well, you've said it, you know, come on, let's all, you know, okay, yeah, I can kind of see a point, you know, various things with the way it goes in the media. But actually, so he phoned me up, and I was expecting fully like, oh, can, you know, I regret what I said there. And he just went, yeah, you know, when we talk about the halo, I didn't go far enough. It needs to be X, Y, Z. And I was like, oh, brilliant. It's really good. So yeah, so that was very kind of Jackie Stewart to do that. But now let's get back to his race of my life, the 1973 Italian Grand Prix. He qualified sixth in a race, you know, that, as we said, he does ultimately decide the title in his favour, but it didn't go quite according to plan, as he alluded to at the beginning. Puncture early on. Cost him ground.
And it started badly even before then. I think he was ill during practice. I think he'd had some immunisation shots or something. So he wasn't very well. The car wasn't very quick, basically. I don't think the Tyrrell 006 is the greatest world championship winning car. I think it was probably more down to the team running it and the man behind the wheel rather than the actual car itself. And yeah, then he started the race. The Lotuses that were his main rival for the championship, Emerson Fittipaldi and Ronnie Peterson, cleared off. And very soon, I think he gained ground initially, but then pretty much straight away had a puncture and fell to the back of the field, to the point where he said he couldn't see anyone. He came out of the pits after his tyre change, For younger listeners, probably worth pointing out that the pit stops were not 2 to 3 seconds in those days, even though there were a lot of punctures, actually. And so he just then got down to effectively, it's a cliche, but it's a sequence of qualifying laps. But actually, he did lap faster than he did in practice to charge back through the field. And he just caught each car, picked it off, kind of clinical execution, really. Just kept going until, and was still charging, was still catching third place Peter Revson's McLaren at the end when the flag flew. So I'm sure he would have continued rising further. I think he set faster lap by half a second. So yeah, just on a different level, really, in a car that I don't think was that spectacular.
The crucial thing with fourth place was that it secured the championship in what was already, he said he was going to retire at the end of that season. So it is a title deciding race, this one.
It is, and it's but there was a bit of confusion even after the race. He wasn't sure that he'd won the championship, and that was partly because of Lotus.
Didn't they protest something?
Well, no, it was more about Peterson and had a really, although he'd been fast all year, had a lot of unreliability problems, especially early on. And Fittipaldi had scored more points, so was still in the championship contention. And Fittipaldi had, as he understood it, had an agreement from Colin that Colin Chapman, team boss Colin Chapman, would move Ronnie out of the way to let Fittipaldi win to keep his championship hopes alive. And as we know from what happened later with Mario Andretti, Ronnie Peterson was a very honourable guy. He would have done whatever was asked, I think. But Colin just never asked him. So Peterson won the race, Fittipaldi was second, Stewart charged through to fourth, and that was enough for the championship to be done and dusted before the two flyaway races in Canada and America.
I wonder whether, because Stewart sort of, he says in his Race of My Life that the team maybe didn't expect him to put in the drive he did when he was so far down after the pit stop. They were sort of like, he's ahead in the World Championship anyway, I guess would be the thinking, and he's at the back. He probably might not give it his all, but he did, and he turns it around. So, you know, what did you make of that? What did you make of that line from Stewart there?
I find that quite surprising, actually, especially by then. You know, it's his last season of F1, and he'd worked with Ken Tyrrell and his team for many years by then, because obviously they were running the Matras before they became a constructor in their own right. And there are quite a few examples of Stewart sort of, okay, so he wasn't a risk taker. You know, he picked his moments, which I think is why he was the best driver of the year, even if he wasn't always the fastest. But I can't think of any examples where he kind of just threw in the towel because he was a long way behind. I mean, at Spa, he was in 67 with the BRM. He was holding the H16 in gear. Okay, so admittedly, he still felt he had a chance to win the race because of what was going on with Eagle and Lotus. But, you know, that's not the act of a driver who's like, oh, this is a bit hard, I'm going to give up. So, yeah, I was surprised by that line. It's a shame we've not got Ken Tyrrell still around to ask him, because I wonder if Ken really thought that Jackie was going to give up.
Absolutely. Well, I consider you a guru, a go-to guy on historical F1 stuff, particularly this era, as I know you're a Stewart fan. But I want to ask you, because Stewart references this, that he was getting a pit board signs from the team, including one that says -45 Fangio. What does that mean? Because I can't even guess.
Fangio is one of Stewart's heroes. I mean, I think Fangio's heroes to lots of people coming through.
As he should be.
I think that was a bit of a joke from Ken Tyrrell, really. Showing, you know, you're going so fast, you're catching Fangio, sort of thing. And that's sort of just a little joke, probably to keep Jackie interested. It may even have been a little reference to Fangio's great drive in the 57 German Grand Prix, where he was getting the countdown to catching the leading Ferraris as well. So, I think that was just a little thing to keep Jackie amused while he was charging back through the field.
I do like it shows you what different level these drivers operate to, that a pit board, a message like that can go up and the driver will just go, oh right, yeah, I get that, yeah, okay, right, there's a coded message going on there, or to keep someone amused or something.
I think the top drivers normally have this extra capacity, don't we? You know, there's, you know, Jenson Button working out the championship score while putting in the fastest lap, I remember it in a Grand Prix a few years ago, and Alonso talking about all sorts of different things while going around. Yeah, the real top, Schumacher changing the balance in the car between corners on a qualifying lap, something that Hamilton actually does, Lewis Hamilton does as well. So, yeah, the top guys tend to have, they're so on top of the game, they've got extra capacity for whatever else is going on.
Pretty superhuman. Why don't we quickly talk about the battle at the front? It was a Lotus domination in the end.
Yeah, I think the Lotus 72 is the fastest car of 1973. Not always the most reliable, but was the fastest. I think, with all due respect to Denny Holman, Peter Revson, the McLaren M23 was probably capable of winning the World Championship that year as well, but didn't have, you know, I don't think either of those were in the sort of Stuart Fittipaldi, Peterson level at that point. So yeah, the Lotus is just cleared off at Monza. I mean, the Lotus 72 was good enough to win that race the following year. Peterson won again in the 72. So yeah, it was you know, quick wedge shaped car when it first came in. It was quick in a straight line for a DFV car because it didn't have the, you know, the radiators on the side rather than the front. So yeah, it was a Lotus 72 benefit at the front. Really, the only tension was, I guess, the waiting to see if they would move the cars around, and they didn't.
Absolutely. Now, I enjoyed Stuart's descriptions after the race of how he was absolutely mobbed by the crowd after securing the title. And I think he and his wife have to hide in a toilet at one point that they have to escape from.
Yeah, pretty interesting that, isn't it? Because he was, although actually he was lined up to be a Ferrari driver at one point earlier in his career, a bit of miscommunication and messing about meant that he didn't. A little bit like Stirling Moss, really. He spent pretty much his entire career stopping Ferrari's winning, or being one of the main thorns in their side. So it's interesting that he was so well received, you know, in Italy, you know, at Monza, home of Ferrari and all that. But maybe it's just the drama of the drive. I imagine that he probably brought some entertainment to that race that, you know, was otherwise a bit lacking.
He retires a race before the end of the season when his teammate Francois Sever, he very sadly is killed in a crash at the US Grand Prix at the end of the season, and Stuart doesn't take part in the race. I wonder, just a question to consider, would, if the title had still been on the line, presumably do you think he still would have raced?
Oh, that's a very good, that is a very good
tough
question,
one, isn't it?
Because it is, yeah. I would imagine that'd be the sort of conversation that he'd have, a decision he'd have come to in conversation with Ken Tyrrell, really. I think that you could probably have sort of spun it to say that Sever had worked hard in 73 and had followed Stuart on a couple of occasions in team 1-2s and things to help him win the championship, that it would have been, in a way, it then becomes worse to throw all that effort away by pulling out. So maybe he would have started the race to try and win the championship. But of course, by pulling out, it meant that he had 99 World Championship Grand Prix starts. It would have been his 100th. And he'd won 27 of them, which is a remarkable strike rate, actually. An interesting question. A very sad way to end his career. And, of course, he had decided to retire already early in the year, but he'd been very good at not telling anyone. There are only sort of two or three people that knew. So a lot of people assumed that he was retiring just because of the crash, but actually he'd already decided prior to that.
Well, I think we should return to Jackie Stewart's words for how he described the race at Monza just at the end, and then we'll get into a bit of a debate about what alternatives he might have picked from all the great drives in his career. Stewart says, "The car felt good that day, and so did I. It is possible to even win a race sometimes, even if you haven't driven your very best and you know that you've made a few mistakes. Monza 73 was one of those days where I felt really satisfied with my own driving." I think that's good. I like that sort of thinking behind the selection. That's just a race that he was really satisfied with his performance, and it comes with the world title as well. But there are alternatives that, as we said, Stuart, you know, his 27 Grand Prix wins out of 99 starts. What a great strike rate. What a great list of achievements, but it does mean that he had plenty to choose from. So Kev, where shall we start? You've done a very good top 10 Jackie Stewart drives for autosport.com and Autosport magazine already. So what would be your number one alternative choice that Stewart could have gone for?
I think the sort of the obvious alternative is the 1968 German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, which, in a separate list, because obviously I love a list, I did the greatest wet weather F1 drives. And I ended up putting that number one because I thought winning a race by 5 minutes around the old Nürburgring in appalling conditions was probably about... Oh, and while injured, because he'd broken his hand a few months before in an F2 accident. That kind of performance is probably the only thing that was going to keep Ayrton Senna or Marcus Schumacher off the top of the list of greatest F1 drives. So that's the obvious one to throw in there. Wasn't particularly rapid in practice. Used the concrete, so the old Nürburgring had sort of asphalt on one side and the sort of concrete pit lane. He drove onto the concrete pit lane at the start, which was allowed in those days. Got more grip, drove past some of the cars, took the lead on the first lap. and was basically half a minute ahead after the second by the end of two laps and just completely disappeared. The only person that kept him, I would say, in sight, but obviously that's a nonsense, but I think Graham Hill was within a minute and a half when he had his own off, and Stewart was out the car on the podium, ready to go for the celebrations when the rest of the field finished. I think he won by nearly 5 minutes, and his fastest lap was 15 seconds faster than the next best lap. So just an absolutely, you know, titanic performance, really.
Completely, and also boosted by the challenge of the circuit, the fearsome, the mighty Nordschleifer. Just a little bit more. Well, I mean, it's easy for me to say this as an F1 racer, but on the face of it, a little bit easier than Monza, perhaps.
Well, this is a point of, I wouldn't say disagreement, but a different viewpoint, really, from how I came to it. So when I did the wet weather list, the reason I put Nürburgring at number one, that drive, was because it's the Nürburgring, the greatest racetrack in the world. Stuart's argument for putting Monza ahead of it, because it did end up on number two on the top 10 list that we did, was that there were only a handful of people that could really master the Nürburgring. So even if he just effectively did his normal job, he knew he'd have a good race at the Nürburgring. Whereas Monza, because it was a much simpler circuit, to take time out of people, you had to be precise and relentless all the time. So to chip away a tenth here, a tenth there, you know, he wasn't 15 seconds of that faster at Monza. You're never going to do that. So he felt that to make the difference at Monza was much harder than doing so at Nürburgring. Now, that rather says something about how good he was, that there were probably only a couple of drivers, probably Jackie Ickx and Jochen Rindt, who were in the same sort of ballpark at the Nürburgring at that time. Whereas, yeah, at Monza, there were more people that could get on the pace. And I thought that was quite an interesting take on it, really.
It is. And I think, again, it shows you the level that the top drivers operate on, because that's just the way they're thinking. I think, like you or I, like me, for instance, if I'm just physically looking at the maps of the two circuits, you go, right, well, that one looks a hell of a lot more complicated, so it must have, like, automatically... winning there would put you above the simpler one. But then that's not taking into an appreciation of just of the difficulty of taking time out of at a track where other people can be automatically fast.
It's almost straddling two different eras as well, those two races, because 68 German Grand Prix is almost like an old school epic. You just can't believe the circuit, you'd never race there now, virtuoso performance, versus a finding of marginal gains, just being a relentlessly on a charge for the whole race, which is more the way that modern races are. You know, no one would say that modern circuits are on a par with the Nürburgring, but the challenge of winning at those circuits is just as great, if not greater than ever, because everyone can get so near the limit. You've got to be on it all the time and as close to perfect as possible to then get the result. And I think that's the difference that Jackie Stewart's talking about. And it's just really interesting that he rates that Monza drive. I think also he was let off the leash at Monza. I think he just didn't effectively felt like he had nothing to lose. I suspect he didn't really enjoy driving in the wet at the Nürburgring. You know, he described it as a monster circuit, and I think everyone had a bit of a sigh of relief when they left there, everyone in one piece. Whereas Monza is probably a bit more. I suspect he was closer to the limit of the car at Monza than he would have been at the Nürburgring. Also at the Nürburgring, he had a tyre advantage. I think the Dunlop was probably the best tyre to have on the day. Whereas, obviously, at Monza, the tyre was the problem. That's what triggered the whole thing.
Absolutely. But I also like a little bit of insight. And it's so great that you were able to sit down and talk to him about these choices, because he says he'd reckoned that if it had been a dry race, he probably would have lost, presumably because the hand injury, which he eventually gets strapped up ahead of that race, would have held him back compared to other two who, obviously, because when you're driving in the wet, you know, you're not quite, you're at the limit, but it's not at a physical limit.
The forces involved are a lot less. I mean, obviously, you'd have been doing a lot of correction. And he did have one moment where he did almost lose it, but held it together. So I think, yes, the strain on his arm, his hand, would have been less in those wet conditions. But again, it's quite remarkable. The conditions helped me. Well, yes, they sort of did help me. Also, they were described by Autosport as possibly the worst conditions at the Nürburgring since the Second World War. So, yes, helpful, but also an incredible challenge at the same time that probably modern racing driver would look at and go, I can't believe they had that race.
Completely. And again, it just gives you an insight into the thinking behind all these things. Another alternative that Stuart could have gone for, the 1969 Italian Grand Prix at Monza, a slipstreaming epic. He seals his first world title, goes from third to first in the Matra. Yeah, it ticks all the boxes as a great. But why would this trump 1973?
I think the two things going for it. One is a dramatic race. You know, it's got two tenths of a second or something cover the top four across the line. It's one of those classic F1 clips that you like to find on YouTube, really. But also, for me, it should be rated highly because it's all about the preparation. So he spent, when we sat down and talked about it, he said he thinks this is the only example that he could remember where he spent all of practice just on one problem, which was getting the gearing absolutely right so that he could hold, I think it's fourth gear, to the line, so he didn't have to change into top until after he'd gone past the start finish line, because he knew that there was a good chance it would come down to a slipstreaming finish. And for a while, I think there are seven or eight cars in the lead group. It gradually gets whittled down to four, and he's in a fight with Jochen Rindt, who is a slipstreaming master. I've been doing some work on him, and he won an awful lot of Formula 2 races. And a lot of those were slipstreamers, and he was very good at putting himself in the right place at the right time. You know, it's not a coincidence that these guys are the ones that do all the winning. Stuart, I think, was similarly good at racecraft, but the difference was that Rince Lotus was slightly undergeared, and Stuart could hold fourth on the run to the line. So Beltoise comes barreling down the inside, runs wide. Stuart tucks up underneath him, and Rince, well placed. He comes out on the gearbox of the Matra, pulls out, but that doesn't go anywhere. He just finishes side by side with him. So I think it's an example of someone being just so on top of the whole game, the preparation, the being in the right place at the right time. And it's known in the reports as being an incredible slipstreaming epic, and lots of different drivers led the race at various points. But if you look at laps led, Stuart led across the line all but 10 laps, despite there being seven or eight different people in that group, because he'd made sure that he was quick in the place he needed to be quick. I think that's pretty cool.
Absolutely. It shows you the just how much that preparation, that focus, and that level of thinking and that detail. It's just tremendous. And he gets the ultimate reward with the first world title.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think Stuart and Rindt were sort of head and shoulders above in 69. I guess that's probably a bit unfair on Jackie Ickx, because he was the coming man at Brabham before he went back to Ferrari. But they were the two, the difference being that the Matra was reliable. So another race that we could mention be the 69 British Grand Prix, where the two of them...
Oh, we're going to get there.
Are we? Okay.
Let's go there now.
Yeah, yeah. So it's Silverstone aficionados would say this is one of those great British Grand Prix. Rindt and Stuart clear off, two best drivers in F1 going at it, slipstreaming each other, repassing and pulling away from the field. I think 3 seconds clear of the field at the end of the first lap, disappear down the road. And really, Rindt breaks away at one stage and Stuart sort of chips away, gets back to him again. And in the end, the battle only ends because Stuart notices that the rear wing end plates begin to kind of hang down, and he's worried that it's going to cut Jochen's rear tyre. So he goes past and gesticulates. Rindt notices it in his mirrors, comes in, changes, you know, gets it sorted, comes out again. But obviously the race is lost. Stuart would have won the race anyway because Rindt then runs out of fuel, kind of a Lotus cutting it a bit fine type jobby. So Stuart would have won, but it was a great duel between the two of them, and they were good friends as well. The one of the things I found fascinating speaking to Jackie about this, which is a complete contrast to the Monza race, is that he claims to have not got a plan for the last few laps. He said, oh yeah, when I got to the last four or five laps, I'd have probably thought about how I was gonna deal with it. But until then, they were just taking it in turns to slipstream back past each other. They both knew it was all going to be about the last few laps. But I just thought it was interesting that at the point that Rindt had his problem, Stuart hadn't yet decided exactly how he was going to play it.
Well, perhaps that shows just the sheer amount of effort it was taken out of both of them, because they were just so focused on the moment.
I didn't know
what they were going to do later on yet.
I think Rindt was the guy who was fast enough to really test Stuart, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why Stuart has that race on his own. When we were talking about it, has it quite high on the list. I think we ended up putting that in at number 5, I think it was. It's a race that he was really, one of the ones he wanted to talk about the most. I think probably because of his personal relationship with Rin, and the fact that I think by then they knew that the other one was the main threat in a kind of a Prost Senna way, but as mates rather than as enemies.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many fascinating things when it comes to researching and preparing for these podcasts. But what I particularly enjoyed about this one was just the sort of the sportsmanship of the era. And this is a great example of it in that race where Stewart has pointed out a potential problem and he's worried that it, you know, could cause a massive accident for Rint. So Rint comes in. Yeah, there's a good example in the 65 Belgian Grand Prix where Jim Clark has cleared off in the distance and he's being chased by Graham Hill and Stewart and their teammates and Hill waves Stewart through because, you know, it's so dangerous and the conditions are so difficult, and he's holding his teammate up. It's like, there you go, get ahead. And you know, you've just got that. It's that sportsmanship. You know, Clark also says at the end of that race he was worried that Stewart was overdriving, and you know, because they're good friends and that sort of thing. And obviously, you know, it's very difficult to compare eras in motorsport. It's one of the constant challenges that we face. A good one to have, though, admittedly. But you know, the safety increase, the sort of the accessibility of the TV and the modern technology, you know, the constant communication with the drivers sort of eliminated that, really. But it's just fascinating to read about, you know, just how much they cared about each other in those eras.
Yeah, it was a different world, and I think partly because it was so much more dangerous. And of course, Jackie Stewart himself was, you know, one of the key people to go from, you know, losing a driver once every couple of years or worse at one stage to, you know, it happens so very rarely now, fortunately. But I don't like it when that gets used as a way to criticise current drivers, because it's not their fault that the sport is the way it is. You know, it is just
absolutely
different.
Yeah.
You have to judge the guys within context. But I think you're right. I think they were, you know, I think at one stage Stewart and Clark lived together, and it's just a different dynamic, really. But actually, that 65 Belgian Grand Prix was one I didn't have on the list, because I thought, well, Clark beat him by 3/4 of a minute in the wet. But to be fair to him, Jackie Stewart said, well, yeah, but that was my first year of Formula One. Clark was my hero, and we finished miles ahead of everyone else. So to finish second to Jimmy in those conditions was a really special moment for me. I thought, well, I'm not going to argue with that. Fair enough. I suspect the Lotus was probably also a better car than the BRM2.
Yeah, it's interesting as we said, you being able to chat to Jackie Stewart about this, because there's another example of him disagreeing with something, which would be the 1971 Monaco Grand Prix, where he wins from pole position in a very fine performance with damaged rear brakes. But and at one point, I think he's sick in the car, according to the reports. But he doesn't rate that, because he's just like, well, I qualified on pole at Monaco, and that's all you have to do, because no one can get by.
Yeah, he actually said, I don't think it's that difficult to win Monaco. If you qualify well and you don't make mistakes, you can win. So that, I mean, that you can't deny that. That is true. But he found out on the grid that they basically that had no rear brakes. And the team
like, there's nothing we can do.
Well, sorry.
You know, go into Sandebot.
One of the most challenging circuits in the world, from pole position, whole length of the Grand Prix, but you've only got front brakes. And he said something like, oh, you know, but I managed to hold on. Quick enough to do the job was the quote. Which was a bit of an understatement, because he actually cleared off. I mean, it wasn't like it wasn't a Daniel Ricciardo, you know, cars behind him, don't make mistakes. He just disappeared, basically. Just a phenomenal performance. I mean, I think probably one of the reasons he doesn't rate that so highly is, I suspect, you know, he was 1.2 seconds faster in qualifying. The Tyrrell 003 was obviously a handy piece of kit around there, so he probably felt that, you know, maybe the car and the situation was compensating for the lack of rear brakes. But I still think that's... I slotted it into the top 10 at number 9. And he did sort of say, well, yeah, I suppose it was a good win. And that was about as much as he'd to go for it. But, you know, fair enough. I can be more impressed by it than the man behind the wheel.
Oh, I think that's so brilliant. I really do. Let's go for one final alternative that Stewart could have had for his Race of My Life. And this is one I'm particularly interested in, because, as I know, we've discussed on this podcast before how much I love a charging drive. The 1973 South African Grand Prix at Kyalami. Stewart comes from 16th on the grid to win for Tyrrell, but he's had a massive accident in practice. And I gather from reading your top 10 that it was such a huge accident, he doesn't remember all that much about the entire weekend.
No, he couldn't really remember all that much, but he could remember a bit about the crash. It was basically the fastest part of the circuit. He had brake failure, went off, so he's doing 170, 180 miles an hour. Some catch fencing that he'd insisted putting in, he reckoned, made the difference. And he said he had a sort of out-of-body experience. He was completely disorientated. He could only see he'd basically come to a stop I'm gesticulating my hand. That's not very useful, is it, on a podcast? He came to a stop.
I appreciated it. It was...
excellent, excellent. he came to a stop with a sort of white wall immediately in front of him. So all he could see was white. So he's like, am I dead? Is this what's going on? He was completely out of it. Jumped into Francois Sever, his teammate's car, which he didn't fit because Sever was quite a bit taller than him. And just couldn't really get on with it. Qualified 16th. Didn't really like the car in warm-up either. Had a load of changes to it. And then it takes him all of 7 laps to go from 16th to the lead and win the race. So it's almost an anti-climax. You know, a lot of these great drivers have got at least one big charge through the field. You know, we talked before about Fernando Alonso's Valencia drive. You know, most of them have got one big coming, at least one big sort of charge through the field in them. And this is Stewart's, but it's so quick, it's almost over before you notice. I guess the thing that slightly detracts from it is that the one car that could have given him trouble, the McLaren M23 of Denny Holm, has a problem really early on while leading. So Stewart doesn't really have to deal with him, but everyone else, he just goes past and thank you and win from 16th.
Absolutely. Well, as I said, I always favour the great charges that they put in. But what do we think? Do we think that we can overrule Stewart here on his pick for Race of My Life? I'm struggling, I'll be honest.
I'm really reluctant because I think the argument for Monza 73, the way he describes it and as to why, argues why he puts it up there, I just really like that.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
I appreciate is rather subjective rather than objective. But yeah, I think you could say that he was probably close to the limit of the car on that day than he was on the other ones that we've discussed, really. So on that basis, I'd happily, as I did at the time, happily agree with his number one pick.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that would have been a fairly difficult conversation, particularly about the number one. But I think as the host, I've decided I shall be the ultimate arbiter here. But what I'm gonna so therefore, you know, as ridiculous as that sounds, I am definitely going to agree with Jackie Stewart. But the reason why is because of just the explanation he gives of so much thing. It's given us such an interesting discussion here today. That just the way he's explained everything and going on, and even in the Race of My Life feature, separate for when you spoke to him in the top 10, it's just so considered and so useful and just such a genuine pleasure to understand what he was thinking and how he reflects on that race. So I think on that basis, we'll keep Stewart's Race of My Life as it was, which is not a groundbreaking conclusion, but it's the one we've got. So there we go.
Sounds good to me. Not going to argue with that.
Yes, thank you very much, Kev. Thank you very much to everybody for listening to this edition of Race of My Life. Obviously, this is the Jackie Stewart Race of My Life, the 1973 Italian Grand Prix. It's available to read about on autosport.com. And you've also got, as our much discussed Jackie Stewart's top 10 drives that Kev produced is also... Yeah, damn it. Jackie Stewart's top 10 drives, which Kev produced, is also available on autosport.com in the Plus subscriber area. Well, yes, thank you very much again for listening. Do let us know what you think of this episode. If you disagree with anything we said or any of our choices or any of Stewart's explanations, we'd love to hear from you. Get in touch on all our social media channels using the handle @Autosport. So finally, thanks again to Kev. Thanks to you for listening. And very finally, thanks to our editor, Martin Lee, for editing this episode.